Sunday marked the third mass shooting in Khayelitsha just short of 2 months, and residents say they are feeling increasingly unsafe. It was still early evening when a hail of bullets descended on locals outside a spaza shop in Site C, killing 6 men. Police said on Monday that a network of crimes would be investigated as possible motives behind the shootings, including gangsterism and extortion. No arrests have been made. I'm Amy Gibbings, a journalist for News24's multimedia department, and this is The Story. This week we'll be talking to News24 reporter Jenny Evans on the recent spate of mass shootings in Cape Town's largest township. Later, researcher with the Social Justice Coalition, Tandor George, will shed some light on the reasons behind these killings and how people are feeling on the ground.
You're listening to The Story. It's a podcast by News24. We'll speak to journalists and experts about the week's biggest story. This is what we saw, heard, and uncovered this week.
Jenny, this is the third mass killing in Khayelitsha since March, and according to the Western Cape Community Safety and Police Oversight MEC Regan Allen, there have been 400 mass shootings in the province between January 2019 and December 2021. Are we seeing an increasing trend in these tragic events in Khayelitsha?
Well, I don't know where all the other shootings were in the rest of the Western Cape, but certainly I feel as though there are more in Khayelitsha. It's almost as if you have one shooting and you think that's it, and then a few weeks later there's another one and it's just as bad.
Yeah, it's been scary to say the least. Just this week, 2 arrests were made in connection with the mass shooting in Endlovini in March, which claimed the lives of 5 people. And on Tuesday, the accused suspect in the Nkanini shooting was awarded 800 rand bail, which is pretty shocking and doesn't give people much peace of mind.
I think, yeah, people did complain about that. They were saying that they want to know why he's still out on the street, given the seriousness of the crime. But bail, again, is really just to make sure you go back to court. It's to make sure you honor your court date. And that's, you know, they check whether you're a flight risk. If they've checked out where you're going to live and they feel that you will go back to court again, you know, the chances are pretty good that you're going to get bail. But it just, I don't think it makes people feel okay, because they're not sure. This guy might be totally innocent, but he's still out and about.
What I find quite interesting is if you have a sort of terrorist event overseas where someone opens fire on people outside a mall, it gets a lot of attention, a lot of media coverage, a lot of concern. Whereas now, in less than 2 months, we've had 3 mass shootings, and I think collectively more than 15 people have been murdered. It's strange that it's just sort of cast aside with little uproar. What do you have to say for that?
I think people can become desensitized if it happens over and over again, which in this case it is. But it doesn't mean that it's not severely affecting the people who live in that area.
How do you think people, you know, from your reporting on the ground, I know that you went to the site on Monday, how are people feeling? What was the sense that you got from the site on Monday?
Well, firstly, people will say that they didn't see anything, which I can completely understand, because if you don't know who you're dealing with, you don't know if you'll be eliminated if you give the police incriminating evidence. And the police raised this as well. They said it's a problem right in the beginning. Nobody sees anything. Nobody hears anything apart from the shots, of course. But what I did pick up was that area is a combination of freestanding brick houses and shacks. So now you can imagine running for cover into a shack. You are honestly not going to have much of a chance. If a bullet is fired in your direction, it's going to go right through the corrugated iron. And that was raised as a fear. People are really, really worried, because where do you even run to?
On Monday, I know that police came to visit the site as well. What are the speculations behind what triggered this event?
Well, the Western Cape Police Commissioner, Lieutenant General Thembisile Patekile, he said that he explained it as investigating a network of crimes, a lot of crimes that are interconnected. He mentioned extortion, drug rivalry, drug turf, hijackings, taxi violence, and he says somehow those are all kind of interconnected. So I'm imagining a kind of parallel economy that's difficult to crack. And you can also get a clue from the team that's investigating it. It's the organized crime unit, so they certainly are taking very seriously the possibility that it might be a criminal enterprise, just from what I think.
It was reported that the shootings occurred when about 20 police vehicles were on patrol in the Khayelitsha area. What does this say about the police's effectiveness and the confidence people have in keeping them safe? From what you've said before, it sounds a bit like a rogue state where people are just fearing and not knowing what's going to happen next around the corner.
Well, I think the shooting of 15 May 2021 really showed us a lot, because 13 people were killed in that day all across Khayelitsha in different places. It started off in one place, then it was at another place. And at the time, I was told that as the police rushed to a scene and were all gathered at one scene, there was a shooting much further away. So now they've got all their vehicles in this place, so that place is open, so there's a shooting there for the shooter. So I suspect that if it is an enterprise, I would suspect that they probably are communicating with each other very well to make sure that they evade the police. Because you must remember that Khayelitsha was established in 1985, and the apartheid government was quite deep into their separate developments at the time. Okay, so they were really trying to create these layers of who they thought should be closest to the city. So it would be white people, who people that they called coloured, and then Indian people would live in. And so that Khayelitsha was established right sort of on the outskirts of the city. And at the same time, there was a thing called influx control in place. So if you wanted to go from the so-called, what they called a homeland in those days, which was a pseudo-independent state, you had to have a permit and you had to be able to travel. So already to get to Khayelitsha, if you combine it with the forced removals to put people into Khayelitsha, and this business of having a permit to drive from one end of the other to the other in your own country, you're already creating a subculture of resistance to authority. People learn very easily, very quickly, how to fly under the radar, because if you want to go and visit your daughter, for example, you need a permit. Or you know, they made it really, really difficult for people to just conduct normal life and to travel normally. So I don't think we should be at all surprised that Khayelitsha started already with a system of resisting authority because of those very criminal circumstances. And then after the elections in 1994, there was no kind of real planning. It was just kind of haphazard when people came in and started building. There was some planning, of course, but generally it was pretty haphazard. And people started moving you could quite easily move to Cape Town, for example. You didn't need this permit. So, of course, I'm going to go to Cape Town now. I'll get my house later, whatever. So the actual town planning was more of an afterthought in many cases. So what you have now in Khayelitsha, especially over the last 3 years, with severe accommodation shortages and a desperate need for land, you have suburbs springing up. When I say overnight, you'll see like 3-4 shacks coming up in land that was empty. And then within 2 weeks, you will just see a sea of brand new silver corrugated iron. So what happens there is there's no planning there either. So now if I'll have to check, but I think 3 quite busy police stations already. So now you've got this enormous arrival of new people. I mean, they're quite entitled to live wherever they like in South Africa, but there's no planning for it. And suddenly the police must also now patrol this extra, like, enormous community. Houses are built right really close to the shacks are built really close to each other. So it's pretty easy, if you were criminally minded, it's pretty easy to set yourself up there, because you can get in and out really quickly. The police can't drive down a road and chase after you. All you have to do is just disappear amongst the shacks. So I think that informal, I call them governments because I can't think of a better word for it, but I think informal systems of governance are being formed there as well. And perhaps, I don't know, Amy, I don't even know if this is right, but I just think it's really difficult from a policing point of view to crack this.
Absolutely.
Because you can't, as a journalist, you can't just arrive without making arrangements, because people want to know, who are you? What are you here for? Why do you need to film me? You know, it's actually so bad now for reporters. We used to be able to go and hear all these stories and get so much more information, but now, and you literally have to have a police escort, because so many journalists, almost all of the journalists go there, have been robbed at some point. And this really makes it difficult for us to find out what is really happening.
I couldn't agree more. It actually brings to mind an incident where when I was still working as a freelancer, and we went in with a bunch of photojournalists into Site C particularly, actually, and we were robbed at gunpoint. And in a few seconds, the suspects had disappeared into what felt sort of like a maze. And I can just imagine how challenging it would be for police to even begin a search or an investigation. As you say, there's almost like a pseudo-governance and people running the show that is excludes the police and any sort of authority. And I'm not surprised, you know, it makes sense that it would have developed that way.
Well, I think it makes sense because you need to have some form of organization in a place like that if there is a complete vacuum in authority as we know it, which there is. And as a policeman as well, how would you cultivate an informant network overnight? You can't. That takes a long time to find the right person, to be able to trust. And the suburbs are springing up like this, and I think the police feel maybe they might at times feel they're a little bit out of the loop, but they get it. They get it eventually. They went as far as the Eastern Cape to find one of the people for one of the shootings. So they're certainly on it, but it's taking longer than it would have otherwise if they'd been able to drive down a street, chase after someone, follow clues. It's difficult, I think, for them and for the people who live there.
Thank you, Jenny. You've made some really valuable insights professionally and personally. Thank you for your time. That was News 24 reporter Jenny Evans. We're now joined by researcher and communications officer for the Social Justice Coalition based in Khayelitsha, Tandor George. Thank you for talking to us today, Tandor. Tell me, what are people speculating might be behind these mass shootings, and particularly the most recent shooting in Site C?
So people are, you know, speculating quite a lot of things. Some are attributing the shootings to maybe things called protection fees or extortion fees. Some are speculating that it might be gang-related activity. So, you know, because there's a lack of clarity that we're getting from SAPS, you know, that's what people are speculating on the ground.
Tandor, how are community members feeling at the moment? What is the mood like on the ground? I read a terrible account of bodies just strewn across the road with bullet cartridges littering the ground. It's a very traumatizing scene, one can imagine.
Residents of informal settlements have been feeling unsafe for quite some time. They continue to feel unsafe. They feel forgotten by, you know, our government, because nothing is really being done. There are no concrete solutions being brought forward to show that, you know, there's urgency in terms of fighting crime and urgency in ensuring that people living in informal settlements are safe.
Is extortion a big issue in Khayelitsha? Do you believe that it might have been behind the other shootings that happened in March?
I can't conclusively say that. However, you know, community members have said that, you know, these things do happen, that sometimes people who own brother shops can, you know, be victims of extortion fees.
What is the solution to something like this? Community members, shop owners already feel so vulnerable. Things are already tough. The economy's down. What kind of interventions do you think are needed? Does the Social Justice Coalition have a plan in mind?
So, I mean, in 2014, the Khayelitsha Commission of Inquiry recommendations were released. And that whole process, obviously, it involved all the stakeholders. So police was involved, researchers were involved. And the community also was involved, and they came together to, you know, give testimony to the violence that's happening in informal settlements. And some of those recommendations provided steps that, you know, SAPS could use going forward to make communities safer. And some of those were just installing cameras and ensuring that those cameras are well maintained, so that the police, to help the police when they investigate. Other solutions were increased public lighting, because people don't feel safe more so at night because of high mast lighting, and in some instances no public lighting at all. So it requires a holistic intervention, not just one-sided approach, which is kind of what we've been seeing. We've been seeing Minister Tele coming to communities, trying to talk to people to calm them, but people need more than that. People are actually needing to see change. They are needing more resources, more finances being put towards actively combating crime. We're needing more detectives and investigators on the ground. So it requires a lot of interventions. It requires stakeholders. It requires also for the minister to listen to the communities, because what we see is the minister will come at the wake of, you know, a tragedy, but in between there's very little engagement, very little meaningful engagement between him and the community members. So it's going to require local government as well to come to the party. It's requiring everyone to have a hands-on approach, and it's requiring, I mean, we always say political will, but I mean, that's it, right? The research is there. Civil society is willing to come and discuss and find solutions. You know, we're extending the olive branch, not just the Social Justice Coalition, but so many other civil society organizations are willing to offer their expertise. And we just need that moment where the government can acknowledge that and come, and we can exchange ideas, and because we all want the same thing at the end of the day. We all want safe communities for everyone. Implementation and, you know, plans that can be sustained, not just, you know, media ops and cameras, but, you know, what happens after that, and how do we ensure that we can maintain that positive change moving forward.
Thank you for your time and your really valuable insight. That was Thando George from the Social Justice Coalition. That's all we have time for today. I'm Amy Gibbings.